Hello, everyone. On today's episode, we're going to be discussing why does the stock market go up, and maybe spend a little bit of time on why does the stock market go down with the author, Brian Feraldi. Brian has been a huge part of our community for the last 5 years, and for the last 2 years, he has been working on this book, Why Does the Stock Market Go Up? And I think this episode is going to be a wonderful deep dive into the why of this book and some important, very important investing philosophies that you can carry with you into your own investing strategy and into conversations that you have with your partner, your spouse, your friends, family, kids. It's just a wonderful primer for talking about understanding your why behind a basic investing strategy, a long-term mindset. Welcome to the Ultimate Crowdsourced Personal Finance Show. This is Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI. Your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, very excited to dive into this week's episode. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing great. This is really, really exciting. Brian came to me about 2 years ago, probably almost to the day, and said, hey, I have this idea for a book. I want to run it past you. And it was the primer for stock market investing that I think we've been looking for. It's, hey, these are all the questions that I hear over and over and over again about the stock market. People don't understand this, right? They don't have, as we've talked about, Jonathan, so many times, we don't get lessons in personal finance. Well, Brian set out to write the book on the stock market and long-term investing. And I love this endorsement from Tom Gardner, the co-founder of The Motley Fool. He said, Brian has written a book you can hand to anyone and know that they'll become smarter, happier, and richer for it. Required reading for those seeking lifelong profit from lifelong investment. And I think that sums it up beautifully. So Brian, welcome back to Choose FI and congrats. The book's coming out tomorrow. That's got to feel amazing.
Great to be back, guys. And yes, I am thrilled to get this book out there in the world.
Well, you worked very hard to get it to the finish line here. And it struck me, you know, even as Brad was saying that the financial independence community and Brad and myself, we have a bias, a historical bias towards, you know, index fund investing. And we're not alone in that. And you are probably the first individual to push back at that to some degree and say, index fund investing is amazing. I am an index fund investor, but let me tell you why I also get so excited about finding and identifying great companies. And I think what brings that full circle to this conversation is that as index fund investors, we sometimes lose sight of the facts of what those funds, those index funds represent, that they represent thousands of individual companies that are producing. And I think the actual underlying mechanics of why does an index go up or why does an index go down gets lost in the noise, where maybe it's an easier conversation when you're saying, here's why a stock goes up in value. Here's why a stock goes down in value. Here are the underlying principles for why a stock even exists.
Yeah, that's so true. To your point, take any index fund that's out there, the Dow, Jones Industrial Average, S&P 500, the NASDAQ Composite. What are they really? They are a collection of dozens, hundreds, or thousands, depending on which one you're talking about, of individual companies. And those indexes go up over time, largely because the companies that are in those indexes go up over time. So when it comes to understanding how the stock market works, I think you have to go one level below that and really get an understanding of how an individual company works. And from there, you can scale it up and understand, ah, that's why the stock market goes up and down.
So let's wind this back and go back to your initial questions as a young investor about the stock market. And I'm just curious, like your perspective on what stock market investing was maybe in high school and early college, and then compare and contrast that to your understanding today.
Yeah. So like many people, I had irregular exposure to the stock market growing up. I remember there were a few instances when I was reading a newspaper or overhearing somebody talk, and they said things like Dow Jones Industrial Average, points, investing, stock, etc. And I had no idea what those terms meant, but I knew that they were important in some way. And one story that really hit home for me was I was a caddy in high school at a local country club. And during a round, some of the golfers, this was on a weekday, went inside to get, you know, some beer, some hot dogs, et cetera. They came back out. They said, "You're not going to believe this. The Dow Jones was up 300 points today." And this was in the late 90s, the go-go era of the dot-com, when just stocks were going berserk. And everybody was so excited, right? They were like high-fiving each other, like, no way. They were like doing the mental math of how much money they had made that particular day. And I was excited for them. I was like, that's good. That's great.
That's
great news.
That's going to
be a good tip. But I had no idea what the Dow Jones Industrial Average is, right? That term gets thrown around all the time, but it was never explained to me. Well, what the heck is that? What is a point? What is the stock? What is the stock market? Why do these things go up and down over time? So those terms were never really explained to me in any way. And by the way, I say that as somebody that was a business major in college. I got an undergraduate degree in business and I graduated college still having no clue what the Dow Jones Industrial Average is or investing or anything like that. Now, for whatever reason, as soon as I came across some books that talked about that, I just became immediately interested in the topic. I don't know why. It just has always fascinated me. So that put me on a never-ending learning binge. And I've read every book that I could get my hands on about the market. I've been on discussion boards. I've listened to podcasts, audiobooks. And slowly, I kind of filled in all of the knowledge gaps that I had about what is a stock, what is the stock market, what is the Dow. And it always kind of bothered me, like, you know, if this stuff was just explained simply to me 10, 20, 30 years ago, I would just be in a completely different place. So that's in a large part why I pitched the book idea to Brad. I just thought, why isn't there a book out there that just explains the extreme basics of the stock market in super easy to understand language?
Yeah, I love it. And you actually piqued my interest. So just super quick, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. I'm sure there are people out there listening who are like, okay, I've heard that term a million times. How would you succinctly describe it, what that is precisely? Because you see it everywhere, right?
Totally. And so when you understand the history of the Dow, it totally makes sense what it is, but we're never given that very basic history. So here's why the Dow existed and what it is. Back in the late 19th century, 1896 to be precise, there was a guy named Charles Dow, and he was the editor-in-chief at what is now known as the Wall Street Journal. And just like today, there were publicly traded stocks. And the way that you got stock information, stock prices in those days, the sole source was the newspaper. So every day, the Wall Street Journal was printing out these tables and tables of stock prices, just like they're still doing today. However, Dow was really frustrated because these tables would come out, some stocks would be up, some stocks would be down, but there was no way that he could summarize what happened with the stock market in general that particular day, right? Some stocks went up, some stocks went down. So he went to his business associate, who was named Edward Jones, and he looked for help. So what the two came up with was that they looked at the 12 largest industrial companies of the day. Industrial companies largely dominated the stock market at the time, and they added up their share price. That was an information that was very easy to get. So they took these 12 large industrial companies, they added up their share price, and then they divided that total by 12. Now, what's it called when you add a bunch of numbers up and then divide by the number? That's called averaging, right? So they invented the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And finally, they could report this number in the paper, and it would give their readers an idea of what happened in the stock market, broadly speaking, that particular day. Now, this number has been recorded every day since 1896, and that has given investors historical data to look at to judge how has the stock market done over a day, week, month, year, etc. Now, over time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average evolved to keep up with the changes that are going on in the world. Gradually, the Dow went from being just 12 companies to 30 companies. So the list was expanded and some companies merged or went out of business or changed their name. And the Dow has evolved to kind of keep up with that. So currently there are companies like Apple and Home Depot and United Healthcare that are in the Dow. But that's what the Dow is. It just represented a small sampling of companies that investors could use to look at and get a representation for what happened to stock market prices broadly that day.
So I like the concept in theory, right? Okay, I have some sense of, are things going well? Are things going poorly? But that seems extremely simplistic to just take the share price, add these 12 up and divide by 12, right? There's no nuance to that of, hey, how big is that company? How many shares do they have? And I would love to hear your thoughts on that, A, maybe how that's evolved over the years. But if there's some interplay here between current day index funds and how some of those, there's cap weighted index funds, I think that's how most of them are, right? But your thoughts on how this is all evolved, because sure, it's cool to talk about, okay, how did Dow Jones start in 1896? But there are current day implications to this.
For sure. So why did the Dow Jones Industrial Average use the dollar price of one share to figure out the index? Well, the answer there was that information was readily available and the math was very simplistic to be done by hand. Now, there's a problem with that. Companies can have as many shares outstanding as they want. And that directly impacts the dollar price of one share of their stock. This is something that confuses a lot of people. This is one of the reasons that, say, Tesla, for example, is currently trading at $1,000 per share, and a company like Ford is currently trading for about $16 per share. Yes, those companies are vastly different sizes, but the main reason that there's such a big difference in their share price has to do with the number of shares that are outstanding. Tesla chose to have 1 billion shares outstanding. Ford chose to have 4 billion shares outstanding. Those numbers are truly arbitrary. So to your point, Brad, the dollar price of one share doesn't give you a true indication for how big and important that particular company is. Now, that is a weakness of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It's weighed according to share price. So the higher the dollar share price of one share of stock, the bigger influence it has over the index, and the lower the dollar price of one share, the smaller impact it has over the index. So S&P, Standard & Poor's, saw that weakness in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and they created a competing index that kind of fixed that flaw. So rather than using the dollar price of one share, which is called the price weight index, they used to weigh it the market capitalization, which is like the total equity value of a company. And that makes a whole bunch more sense because the larger a company is in terms of size, in terms of market capitalization, the bigger influence it plays. So that's how the S&P 500 is weighed. It's a capitalization weighted index, which is diametrically opposed to the Dow Jones's price weighted index. So many stock market indices that are popular today do use a market capitalization weight method as opposed to a price weighted method. But when you understand that the Dow Jones started out by being calculated by hand, it makes sense why it used price weighted.
So Brian, you mentioned the Dow and then you contrasted that with S&P. You know, just to kind of complete this out, as I kind of think about three that I always see on the news, the third one would be the NASDAQ. Help me figure out where this fits in terms of how they evolved in terms of their own personal tracking.
Sure. So the NASDAQ, NASDAQ, that stands for the National Association of Security Dealers Automated Quotations. Boy, is that a mouthful. What the heck does that mean? Yeah.
NASDAQ sounds better.
Yeah, right. NASDAQ does sound a whole lot better. Well, in the early 1970s, computing technology, computers, had become much more advanced than they had over the preceding decades before that. And there was a big problem back in the 60s and 1970s, and that was it was hard to get pricing information, right, the price of what shares were trading at, to all investors at the same time because there was just simply a delay. So the National Association of Security Dealers decided that they were going to create a brand new stock exchange that existed completely on computers. Doing so would make it very easy for them to get pricing information to everybody at the same time. So in 1971, that's when the NASDAQ was officially launched, and it was a computerized system for buying and selling stocks. It was the first time in history that it happened. Well, at the time, that was a very attractive thing for tech companies in particular to list their stocks on. For one reason, they were selling the computer technology to the NASDAQ, but they just liked the idea of being traded electronically versus the old-fashioned way. So the NASDAQ Stock Exchange launched in 1971. Currently, there's more than 3,200 companies that are listed on the NASDAQ. And just like the S&P, it's a capitalization weighed index. It's not a price weighed index. But that's largely the history of the NASDAQ. And there's a composite, there's an index that tracks the stock prices of all the companies that are on the NASDAQ. And that's called the NASDAQ composite. So whenever you see that number given out in the newspaper or on the news, that's what it's tracking. It's actually tracking the price movement of more than 3,000 companies that trade on the NASDAQ Stock Exchange.
Perfect. So this is really where I was wanting to go with this. There's a difference between the initial reason that the Dow existed as a way to represent the daily happenings, as opposed to where we are now, where some people do, in fact, just buy the NASDAQ and sell the NASDAQ, and they buy the S&P 500 and they sell the S&P 500. Do people buy the Dow and sell the Dow? I would imagine there's a way just to directly do that as well, but that is different than the initial reason that the Dow Jones Industrial Average existed. Those are two kind of separate things. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's correct. There are index funds today that just blindly invest in the Dow, just like there's index funds today that invest in the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ composite. Those came after, well after, the creation of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But yes, you can invest in the Dow Jones Industrial Average today.
Right. And that's the beauty of index funds, is we can essentially make an index fund about anything, right? As you're saying, the original version was to track, but now you can invest very, very easily. So I wanted to ask a follow-up about something you said in there about Tesla versus Ford, and just clarifying. So as you described it, Tesla stock is about 1,000. Obviously, we're rounding here, right? Ford stock is at about $16 per share. But as you said, there are 4 billion shares of Ford versus 1 billion of Tesla. So kind of an apples to apples in this case would be to multiply Ford's stock price by 4 to get a roughly apples to apples. But basically, how I look at this is the market cap. So you take the $1,000 per share of Tesla times the billion shares, and that company is worth about $1 trillion, right? Whereas Ford, you would take the 4 billion shares, multiply by 16, and get to about $64 billion as the total value of the market capitalization of Ford stock. So that's kind of, for everybody out there listening, to get an understanding of roughly what these companies are worth. But Brian, I would love to hear you talk about valuation, because I think this is where people get caught up. Ford has been around forever. They sell millions of cars, I think far more than Tesla, but Tesla is worth roughly 15 times as much as Ford. And what's interesting, actually, I listened to the Masters of Business podcast from, it looks like March 19th. And this was great. It was with the Ford Motor Company's new VP for electric vehicle programs, which was fantastic. And Ford is investing $50 billion in EVs and such. But I'm curious, like, how do you think about valuation of companies like this? Tesla obviously is this brand new company. It's super exciting. Ford, people think of as this stodgy old company, but yet it looks like they're going to put their weight behind EVs. Like, how would somebody like me, who knows so little about valuation of a company, like, think through this? Okay, Tesla is worth 15 times currently what Ford is, but it looks like Ford is going to try to get in on Tesla's turf. Like, how do you think about that?
Well, let's go with the fact that you picked pretty much the hardest valuation example we could possibly do, which
You're
is
welcome,
valuing
my friend.
Tesla's
You're welcome.
Stock today. So Tesla is an outlier of an outlier of an outlier. And I think it's actually one of the hardest companies in the world to value, simply because the company is growing so quickly. The future is so unknown, and it's become such a popular name with so many investors, driven mostly by the popularity of Elon Musk. That's an incredibly hard company to value. But to your point, one very simple valuation metric that we can use to look at compare these companies is called the price to sales ratio. So the price to sales ratio. So essentially, this is a ratio between the market cap, or the dollar price of one share of these companies' stocks, divided by the sales of these companies per share. And this can just give you a sense of how excited investors are about Tesla and how unexcited investors are about Ford. So currently, Tesla is currently valued at about 21 times sales. What that means is for every dollar that Tesla brings in sales, investors are valuing the company at 21 times that number. 21 times that number. That's what Tesla is currently trading for. Now, is that high? Is that low? That's very high. That's a very, very high number. And the reason investors are willing to do that today is they believe that Tesla is going to substantially grow its revenue over the next 1, 3, 5, 10 plus years. I mean, Elon Musk is on record saying we plan to grow our revenue 50% per year for the essentially the foreseeable future. Now, let's compare that number to Ford. So Ford is currently valued at 0.5 times sales, meaning for every dollar that Ford brings in sales of its cars and services, investors are valuing the entire company at 50 cents. So Ford has much bigger sales than Tesla does. However, Tesla is valued on its sales at a much higher rate. Now, why is that? Well, currently, 99% of Ford's sales are tied to internal combustion engines, right? Gas-powered cars. And if you believe, like I do, that say 10 years from now, that business is going to be rapidly heading towards zero or completely being disrupted by electric cars, that's the market's way of saying we don't value this part of your business much at all. Now, if you've studied Ford, Ford's actually splitting into two separate companies to account for this fact. So they're splitting off their internal combustion engine business away from their electric vehicles in order to have the market revalue their electric vehicles at a higher rate. But broadly speaking, that's why there's such a big difference in valuation between these two companies. Investors are believing, Wall Street believes that Tesla is going to grow and electric vehicles are going to take market share. Investors believe that internal combustion engines are on a slow path towards completely being displaced by electric cars. And that's why there's such a huge valuation difference between those two companies.
So splitting, that's interesting. So Ford, when you say Ford is going to split their company in two, will that mean under the same share price, most likely under the same share? Or is this going to be like a completely distinct company in essence?
Yep, it's going to be a completely distinct company. So if you buy a share of Ford today, once the split takes place, you'll own two different shares of Ford stock. One will own all the assets of the legacy internal combustion engine business, and another one will be own all of the assets of the growing EV business. So this is a case where Ford is going to be literally splitting in half.
And your one share of Ford now will end up being one on each side after the split?
You got it. You got it. So the total value of your ownership won't change on day one, right? The company is currently valued at, what was it, $64 billion. I don't know what the split out is going to be, but let's just say the EV one is worth $10 billion and the internal combustion is worth $52 billion, whatever the numbers are. So the value won't change, but Ford is doing so because they believe the EV company, which will be growing very rapidly, will be awarded a much higher valuation in the market, and that will create value for shareholders. It also removes some internal conflicts of interest that they have, right? So these two businesses are going to be competing against each other in some ways. So splitting them off and giving them completely different CEOs, completely different R&D teams, I think makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
Hey, this is Andrew from the Choose FI team. Hope you're enjoying the interview. We're going to get right back to it right after these quick messages.
It's so funny, Brian, as you guys are talking about this, I agree with your assessment. I watched the latest Super Bowl and like every car manufacturer is just saying EV, EV, EV. And it's kind of like, even as we're saying this now, it's not like I'm particularly nostalgic about gas guzzling vehicles. I don't really care, but there is this aspect of me that recognizes we're moving from one age to another. And like the year is 1992, I'm walking into Blockbuster and picking out a video with my dad, you know, and getting that. I had no idea how good I had it. And then like now you're on the other side and there are no Blockbusters left. There are no gas stations left. There are no, like, Blockbuster was everywhere. It was literally on every corner. It was going to be here forever. The world changed. Netflix is in every home. And there's one Blockbuster left in Oregon as a token Airbnb, right? Like, that's the reality of where you could be in 10 years for those that say, well, there's vehicles everywhere. Like, it's just very interesting to think about. What does it mean that the future is inevitable? Like, it's coming. Anyway, sidebar there. But yeah, Blockbuster 1992 was a good year.
So that, Jonathan, is a great example of why investors are valuing Tesla and Ford at such different rates. right now. If you were to run the clock to say 2005 or so, Blockbuster was the dominant company, had way more sales, had these stores all over the place. Netflix was this little upstart business that was doing DVD rentals by mail, and investors were valuing Netflix much higher than they were valuing Blockbuster. Why? Because they believed that Netflix was going to be in growth mode, and they were worried about Blockbuster's future potential. Now, that prediction proved to be correct. Blockbuster eventually went on to go bankrupt, and Netflix is currently worth $164 billion. So that's a great example of how a new business model can come along, a company can disrupt another company, and why there can be such big valuation differences between the two.
It is a great example, but let's also point out for the counterpoint here, if you and I as two people on the side of the streets are aware that Ford is sure as heck, and no one wants to become the next Blockbuster. There is no CEO of a billion-dollar company that says, you know, we're on deck to become, I mean, that is literally, that's what wakes you up in cold sweats in the middle of the night. And it's probably what motivates everyone just to let's get in front of this. All right, Brad, I see you. Go ahead, man.
So, okay. Since we're talking about splits, there've been a lot of high profile stock splits recently in the news. I know I've seen this with Amazon specifically, but what the heck is a stock split? Most people have no idea what this means, like what actually mechanically occurs. And how does it impact the stock price?
Yeah, so Amazon recently made big news when it was announced a 24-1 stock split. So that gets a lot of people excited about it because all of a sudden Amazon stock is going to become, quote unquote, a lot cheaper or a lot easier to invest in. So a stock split is when a company takes the total number of shares that are outstanding and increases it by a certain amount. And by increasing the number of shares that are outstanding, that in turn decreases the share price. So to put some quick numbers on it, Amazon stock is currently trading for $3,300. The entire company is worth about $1.7 trillion, and there are currently just about 500 million shares outstanding. So there's 500 million shares that are in existence. So by doing a 20-for-1 stock split, Amazon is going to be taking those 500 million shares that are outstanding, and it's going to be turning them into 10 billion shares that are outstanding. So if you own one share of Amazon before the split, after it happens, you're going to own 20 shares of Amazon after the split. In turn, the dollar price of one share of Amazon is going to drop by a factor of 20 from $3,300 to about $165 or so per share. Here's the important point. Whether you buy or own the stock before the stock split or after the stock split, Amazon's value, the market capitalization of Amazon, will be completely unchanged. However, Amazon is doing so for a few reasons. One, it becomes a lot easier for smaller investors, which could include the company's own employees, to buy or sell the stock, right? Some people want to invest in Amazon, and if they don't have access to fractional shares at their broker, it's hard to come up with $3,000 to invest in one company, but you could do it if it was, say, $165 or so per share. Here's another interesting point. Remember how the Dow Jones Industrial Average is weighed by the dollar price of one share? Well, at a $3,300 share price, there's no way that the Dow would ever consider putting Amazon into the Dow Jones Industrial Average. If they did so, because it's weighed by share price, it would just exert so much influence over the index that the index would become extremely concentrated into Amazon. However, if they split their stock and get the share price down to $165 per share, suddenly that actually matches relatively closely with what the other stocks in the Dow Jones are trading at, and suddenly they become much more likely to be included in the Dow Jones Industrial Average the next time they go through a round of bringing new companies in.
My immediate gut reaction is, why would anybody high five over what the Dow is doing? What a random arbitrary metric to make your high five decisions on. Just hold that one in.
Well, there is some prestige to saying to your investor base, yes, we're in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So that's one reason that Apple split their stock many, many years ago. Their stock price was so high so that they wouldn't be allowed in the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Yeah, that seems like a fundamental weakness in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, right? Like, we can't include great companies just because our stupid average is messed up. That's ridiculous. But I wanted to ask about beginning investors. And like you implied there, when the stock splits, it's easier maybe for people to invest, right? Because by definition, the price is lower, right? In that case, you said Amazon would just, you just simply divide the current price by 20 in this case, because they're splitting it 20 for one. So talk me through the psychology maybe of stock price and how that leads maybe both sophisticated investors and beginner investors to think about a company. I'm thinking specifically about like Berkshire Hathaway. The A share currently, as we're talking about this, is over $500,000 per share, which is a pipe dream for most people. Whereas I think the B share, it's 1/1500th of that. So it's somewhere around, what, $350, $400 right now as we speak. So talk me through, if any, how price of shares impacts people's psychology, especially for maybe beginning investors.
Yeah, so let's talk about why stock splits existed and why people historically got so excited about them. So 20, 30, 40 years ago, if you were an individual investor and you wanted to buy shares on the market, you had to do so through a broker. And it was very common for brokers to trade with each other in lots of 100 shares. So they would give each other, that would be the trading number that you would have to buy in. So if you wanted to buy, you had to buy 100 shares. If you wanted to sell, you had to sell 100 shares. They would do different numbers. So you could sell one, two, or three, but they would charge much higher commissions because of those odd lot trades. So because of that, because it was very common to trade with each other in blocks of 100 shares, the dollar price of a share really mattered, right? If you were a $10 stock, that would be an $1,000 trade, right? We're talking 40 years ago. And if you were a $100 stock, that would be a $10,000 trade. And even big mutual funds and hedge funds with lots of money, the dollar price of a share, if it went over $100, the amount of money that they would have to trade on to buy or sell was actually a pretty significant number. For that reason, if you look back historically, it was very common for companies to split their stock, and it was very rare to see their share price go over $100. Now, gradually, as the markets have matured and it's become so much easier and so much less expensive for investors to buy and sell in smaller dollar amounts, there has been less of a need for companies to split their stocks in order to buy and sell in smaller numbers. But to your point, really, the person that really vanguarded the movement of keeping your share price high was indeed Warren Buffett. And his A shares are exactly an example of that. You mentioned their one A share is currently worth $500,000. That's not a joke. Buying one share costs $500,000. And I think the year was 2008 or 2009 when Warren Buffett bought Burlington Northern Santa Fe, their big railroad company that he make. That's when he made the decision to split his shares of his B shares to a much lower price. In doing so, gave the employees of Burlington Northern Santa Fe a much lower dollar price that they could trade back and forth. But even prior to doing that, one share of the B shares, which were a fraction of the price, I think were like $3,000 each or something along those lines. So because of the way that trading costs have gone, it's been so much easier for investors to buy and sell in small numbers. Largely, the share price of a company has become mostly irrelevant, but investors still get really excited whenever they see an announcement that a company is splitting its stock.
So Brian, I had a recent experience where I met some people in the FI community, and they were telling me they were interested in real estate investing and all this other stuff. And then they said something that kind of took me aback, and it was, "We don't really believe investing in the stock market." And I was kind of flummoxed because while I understand the sentiment, I understand that a lot of people think investing in the stock market is akin to gambling. It's, you never know, is this going to go up and down? What am I buying? Is this just a sheet of old school sheet of paper, a stock certificate, right? They don't have those anymore. But it really brought to mind that people don't have a general understanding of what the stock market is. What are you buying? Because to me, my initial response to that was, wow, that means there is literally not one company in the world, one publicly traded company in the world that you believe strongly enough that you want to be a part owner of. Because I think that's really how we should think about this, right? When you own a share of stock, you are a part owner, albeit a tiny little owner, but an owner nonetheless of that company. So that's how I think about it. But that sentiment is out there. And first, I'd love for you to corroborate my understanding. And second, what would your response have been to that kind of thought process?
Yeah, that makes sense to me that people think like that, because again, so many of us are never given any education at all in high school, growing up, from our parents, even in college, in my case, about what a stock is, why a stock has value, and why the stock market is such a great place for long-term capital. So many of us, like when we get a new phone, right, a new iPhone, right on the home screen of the phone, you see the stock app, right? And you could pull that up at any time. And what do you see whenever you load any stock app? Prices. That's all you see is stock prices. Was it green today? Was it red today? So if that is your sole exposure to the stock market, it makes complete sense to me why so many people view it as just a giant gambling machine, right? Your goal is to buy the stock for one price and to sell it at a higher price. And maybe you're right sometimes, maybe you're wrong sometimes, but it's natural to me that so many people look at that and just say, forget it, it's gambling, I'm out. And you can, quote unquote, invest in the market and make it a big gambling machine if all you do is buy and sell rapidly. However, that is such a disservice to so many people, because in truth, I truly believe that the stock market is the greatest wealth creation machine ever created. And we are so lucky to be living today, because it's never been easier for ordinary people to build essentially extraordinarily wealth by simply dollar cost averaging and continually buying into the stock market. Let's answer the question that you just asked. What the heck is a stock? Why do they exist? Well, all a stock is it represents fractional ownership of a corporation. It represents fractional ownership of a corporation. It's a record-keeping tool that makes it easy to figure out how much each investor owns in a particular company. Let's say the three of us were going to go into business together, and we wanted to start a very simple candy shop, okay? We do some quick math on this. This candy shop was going to take $1 million to get off the ground. Jonathan Moneybags over there says, guys, I'm going to pony up $500,000 to buy into this candy shop.
Brad Bitcoin says, profits.
Brad says, great, I'm in for $400,000. And I say, hey, guys, I want to be a part of this. I only have $100K to invest. So Jonathan
not
does $500K. Brad does $400K.
Sorry.
I do $100K.
Some people are writing down the business model down here, and you're over here throwing memes, Jonathan, on a podcast. Come on, chill out, dude.
Love it, Jonathan. So how do we figure out who owns how much of this new venture, right? So one easy way that we can figure this out is to create shares of stock. So to make things easy, let's say that we create shares of stock. We price them each at $1 and we sell them to us three, the initial investors. Jonathan buys 500,000 shares. Brad buys 400,000 shares. I buy 100,000 shares. Boom, that's why stocks exist. We now know who owns how much of this particular company. Now, that's a really simple example. You can imagine how important it is to use stocks to own companies when you have more than three investors and they're not investing equal amounts of money. Or what happens if 5 years from now, somebody else says, hey, I want to invest in your company. So stocks make it easy for a record-keeping tool of who owns how much of a corporation. That is what a stock is. And the reason that they have value is a stock represents a legal claim on that company's assets and its future profitability. In a very real way, when a company makes money, that money doesn't belong to the company. It belongs to the owners of the company, which are the shareholders. So to your point, Brad, if you go out and there's a company that publicly trades that you love, you think it has a bright future ahead, when you buy a share in that company, you have a legal claim on a small, tiny bit of that company's current and future profitability. And if that company's profits grow over time, the value of your stock will also grow over time.
Yeah, I love that. So, right, in terms of the very simplistic, like our example where you own 10%, I own 40%, Jonathan Moneybags owns 50%, right? Or a company like Tesla, as you said, that you're buying 1/1 billionth of the company with one share. Or if the car wash down the street from me decided to break their company up into 100 pieces worth 1%, and you wanted to buy one of those shares, right? That's what investing in a stock is. So when you say, oh, I don't invest in the stock market, to me, it literally means there is no company in the world, no publicly traded company in the world that you have any belief in purchasing even a tiny ownership stake of. So like that is a very broad statement. It just doesn't add up for me. I could understand people saying with some nuance of, oh, I think because of these 10 reasons, the stock market is currently overvalued or undervalued. Like, you can make some nuanced arguments, but to say that I, as a blanket statement, don't invest in the stock market makes little to no sense to me.
Yeah, I appreciate the nuance you added on it, because I could certainly see it being someone saying, oh, it's a timing issue. There's uncertainty, X, Y, Z. I think most people, and this is a really good, I think it's an important point. Most people intrinsically understand, even if they can't quite logically explain it, why the stock market might go down. Uncertainty in the world, bad event that could affect something. Like, you know, most of us have kind of a dooms, pessimistic general outlook, and we can say, you know, and so in fact, the stock market has had a rocky start to 2022. But I think the thing that's probably more valuable for people to just keep in mind is, and Brian, I'll give this back to you. Why does the stock market go up? And also, if you could add on to this, I'll give you a little bit of rope here. How often does it go up?
Yeah. So when you are buying an index fund, let's just say the S&P 500 to make things relatively simple, you are literally buying positions in 500 of the biggest, most profitable, most successful companies in America at any given time. So that's what you are buying when you buy the S&P 500. Broadly speaking, those 500 companies that are out there, they're profitable, they are all doing the same thing. They are trying to grow the value of their future profit streams. Growing the value is the job of the managers of those companies. And if they do a poor job, they will literally be fired and new people will be brought in that will grow that profit stream. So the reason that when you invest in the S&P 500 or the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index or whatever, that the value of those things will go up over time is simply because the profits of the companies in that index will also go up over time. And as those profits increase, so will the underlying value of the company, and the investors in those companies will by and large make money. Now, that's the theory. And if you look at investing over the long term, that theory holds water. In fact, one of my favorite statistics on the S&P 500 is this. If you bought the S&P 500 and then held it for various periods of time, let's talk about how often you make money. And this data goes back to the 1870s. So if you bought the S&P 500 and held it for 1 month and then sold it, you made money 61% of the time. So that's better than a coin flip if you bought and hold for 1 month. What happens if you stretch that out to a year? You make money 69% of the time. And I should note that's in real terms, meaning that's accounting for the effects of inflation. So over a 1 year period, you make money 69% of the time. If you buy the S&P 500 and hold for 5 years, you now make money 81% of the time. 10 years, 89% of the time. 15 years, 95% of the time, and 20 years, 100% of the time. If you bought and hold the S&P 500 for 20 years, there has never been a period in stock market history, U.S. stock market history, where you've lost money in real terms. So when people come and they say, I don't like the stock market, I think it's gambling, what they're really doing is they're looking at the stock market over the wrong time period. If you buy shares 1 minute and sell them the next, that is absolutely gambling, right? You're just betting that that particular day, the price of that stock, that index or whatever, will go higher because some investor is willing to pay a slightly higher price than you are. However, if you hold the stock market for its intended time period, which to me is measured in decades, the longer you hold it, the more you put the odds on your side that you will make money. And the reason that that happens, again, is the underlying companies in those indexes that you're buying, they are motivated and they are actively out there trying to grow their profit streams. While plenty of bad stuff can happen in the short term, right? Wars, recessions, terrorist attacks, inflations. Think about all the bad stuff that's happened in the U.S. market history. If you buy and hold the index and hold it for the appropriate period of time, the odds of you making money are extremely good. And if you have a 2-decade time horizon, the odds are essentially 100% that you'll do well.
Wow. Brian, I just think your book is fantastic. I've read it so many times now, and I think that it is a wonderful companion really to the simple path to wealth. And I say that genuinely. It's coming at it from a different angle, and it's looking at it as more at the fundamentals of the underlying stocks that the index funds make up. But I think it's a piece of the puzzle that just we weren't offered. And it's valuable for all of us to be exposed to it and have a better comprehension, and then take that into a long-term investing strategy. You may be a diehard index investor. I think it's still beneficial for you to understand what comprises that index fund. And I cannot think of a better way to get that primer than Brian's book, Why Does the Stock Market Go Up? This is available tomorrow, April 5th, 2022, for those of you that are listening to this after the fact. And if you want to pick up your copy, you can get it anywhere that books are sold, or you can go to choosify.com/up. UP, and that's for Why Does the Stock Market Go Up? We just try to make it simple for you. Go grab your copy, and I think you will get tremendous benefit from the information that Brian has compiled. Again, Brian read every book. So like, if he read every book, why take the time to write this book? Because it's not simple. It's not synthesized. It's not filtered. It's not easy to comprehend. He's doing you a favor. He's saving you time. And it's a fun, engaging read. I think you're going to love it. Brian, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Jonathan, Brad, always great to be here.
All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. Get your copy, choosify.com/up. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.